There's a lot in the news about marijuana these days. Two states, Washington and Colorado, legalized pot for personal use. Oddly enough, pro football teams from those two states will meet in the Super Bowl to decide the NFL champion. Maybe you've already heard the jokes about the two pot states being represented in the big bowl game. But behind the jokes and the two states where pot is legal, there are 48 other states struggling with approaches to marijuana and its production. In our region, where pot grows well, illegal growing operations have been demonstrated to cause environmental damage, and it may be getting worse over time, not better, especially in the Emerald Triangle of the North Coast in California. Scott Greeson is the executive director at the group Friends of the Eel River and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Scott, thank you for joining us.
No problem, Jeffrey. Good morning.
Give us some background on the group and the river that you represent, because the Eel River, among many in California, has been greatly manipulated over the years, hasn't it?
It has, but we like to talk about the Eel River as the greatest river in California nobody knows about. It's about 3,700 square miles of the coast range, basically, and flows, like most of our North Coast rivers, from south to north. The mouth of the Eel is just south of Humboldt Bay, but its sources are way up in the coast range and up east of Ukiah, basically. So we drain a lot of the dry interior part of the region, and so with this drought, the Eel River has been particularly hard hit. The snow that we usually depend on for the headwaters flows just hasn't showed up, and of course it isn't raining here either. So our flows are far, far lower than they would be under normal conditions.
Is some of the stream flow of the Eel diverted elsewhere out of the Eel River Basin?
Indeed. At the top of the Eel is a two-dam, one-tunnel project called the Potter Valley Project that's owned by Pacific Gas and Electric. And for the better part of the 20th century, that project sent most of the upper Eel's flow, most of the flow of the river basin above those dams, down into the Russian River Basin. Since about 2004, those flows have been cut about in half, but it's still a pretty significant amount of water. For example, this year, despite the drought, PG&E sent about 50,000 acre feet of Eel River water down to Russian River irrigators. And then in December, discovered that they didn't have any water left for Eel River fish, and pretty much turned to us with their pockets out and said, well, sorry, we're going to have to cut the flows that are released out to the Eel River. And this is more than unfortunate for the Chinook and Steelhead that are still trying to struggle their way up the river to spawn and make another round of fish. It's particularly unfortunate because the last few years have seen really good numbers, very heartening numbers of fish that looked for a while like we might be turning the corner on a really tragic story of loss through the 20th century. But the combination of the drought, diversions like the Potter Valley Project, and then the thousands of individual diversions associated with marijuana grows bids fair to put a nail in the coffin for the fish rather than helping them make it out.
Granted, Scott, it's not easy to keep track of all the individual marijuana growing operations, but if you had to venture a guess, which is the biggest impact on the river?
I think it's pretty clear that the marijuana industry at this point is the biggest single business in terms of its impact on the river. That's not an easy call to make, as you said, Jeffrey, because nobody knows how many individual operations are out there. We've got some guesses. It's pretty clear that there are at least a few thousand operations. How big they are, how much water they're actually using are really pretty speculative exercises. What we do know is there are a lot of plants. And a lot of plants take a fair amount of water, even if you're growing them very carefully. So they're definitely taking a significant part of the flow in some of the bigger and more important watersheds for our fish. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife has estimated that very roughly speaking, with conservative estimates for the number of plants and the amount of water those plants use, that we're losing about 20% of the flow of some of our key watersheds, as much as 50% in the hardest hit watersheds to marijuana irrigation.
And really, so a fifth of the total flow then is not ending up in the tributaries to the Eel, and therefore the Eel itself.
That's in a couple of the sort of more representative ones, and then one outlet creek, which is the tributary of the main stem Eel that comes out of Willits. They're actually guessing it's closer to half of the what we call the unimpaired flow.
Mm-hmm.
So that by itself is a big deal. The fact is, in most years, we get a lot of water in the winter. And if growers can capture winter rains and use them through the long, dry summer, they can actually grow with relatively little impact. I mean, it's not the weed. It's how it's grown. It's not having a few plants. It's having a few hundred plants that sort of becomes an environmental problem. And really, I think the challenge we're facing has everything to do with what we call the green rush, the dramatic increase in the number of people and in the scale of the operations they're undertaking, basically in a rush to get rich. And we've reached the carrying capacity of this region in a really dramatic way with this drought. And, you know, suddenly the ceilings come down.
Scott Greeson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the executive director of Friends of the Eel River, and we're talking about marijuana growing operations and their impact on the eel and similar streams in Northern California's Emerald Triangle. You can join us here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We've had conversations in the past, Scott, about the other impact of marijuana growing operations, that they're using rodenticides that are affecting some of the native mammal populations and just kind of trashing the areas. Is that as big a factor, stuff going into the Eel and its tributaries, as the water just not getting to the Eel and its tributaries?
Well, there's a couple of different classes of watershed impacts. One we've been talking about is the diversions, taking water out. That's probably the biggest thing by itself. If you don't have water in a river, you don't have the basis for an aquatic ecosystem. Another is the dirt that goes in the river. Just in simple terms, when people clear off areas to put up their giant greenhouses, when they build roads into places that might have poor soil conditions or steep slopes, a lot of times we're seeing sediment impacts, erosion impacts that are really almost indistinguishable from the kind of impacts we saw from the logging industry, from the timber industry that did so much damage to the Eel River through the middle of the 20th century.
Really, marijuana as big an impact as logging?
Well, I'm not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important not to make claims that are so overbroad. What I'm saying is that the sediment impacts we see from poorly designed marijuana growing operations are the exact same kind of sediment impacts we saw from poorly regulated logging impacts. The dirt in the creek doesn't care whether it came off of a logging truck or a grower truck.
Mm-hmm.
It's dirt in the creek, and that's bad for fish. There's a third thing, though, which is, as you suggested, Jeffrey, the introduction of toxics, of pesticides or fertilizers, nutrients that in excess can really poison a stream. That's not as big a deal for the eel, though we still see an awful lot of ugly situations where people have trashed the land, particularly in the context of what we call the trespass grows, the big operations, usually on public lands, sometimes on private timberlands, that appear to be associated with drug trafficking organizations, often Spanish-speaking people. Those are the places where you see people camping out for the entire season and leaving behind big dump sites, as well as streams that have been completely blockaded, fertilizer mixed in the stream bed, that kind of impacts. And that's also where you tend to see, in association with those trespass grows, the dramatic overuse of the rodenticides that have been killing fishers and stuff. So those remain background problems across the region. I would say, though, that that's not the core issue that we're really looking at in terms of the green rush, which is really about can people begin to practice some basic best practices and good management practices on the private landscape where growing weed is now, if not completely legal in California, at least quasi-legal, where people proceed to grow as if they have a right to do it, but don't follow the basic laws and rules about how you're supposed to use water and, you know, how to treat the land.
Let's take some calls here. We have Scott Greason from Friends of the Eel River, the executive director, on the line, and here is Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. I suspect that right now you're just reaping what you've sowed for the last three-quarters of a century as the state has demonized and outlawed pot, sometimes with the most outrageous lies. Just look at Reefer Madness, film made in the 30s. That being the case, I also suspect that the only way you're really going to get it under control is to legalize it, much like they legalized alcohol in the 30s. And that led to a tremendous downtick in the number of moonshiners out there.
Mm-hmm. So it's prohibition, you're saying.
So really, if you're going for a long-range solution, I would suggest that you get behind some kind of a legalization effort, simply because that's the only way you're going to really control it. Because when marijuana is outlawed, only outlaws will have marijuana.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. Appreciate it. Scott, has Friends of the Eel River taken a position on what laws should go on with what the legal approach should be?
We have, and we are supporting legalization, but that's not the end of the discussion. It's really just the start. It's pretty easy to see now that there are legalization options in California that would not help us very much in the Emerald Triangle, which is to say that if we see a kind of legalization that is like Washington and Colorado, very, very tightly restricted to only a few permit holders, particularly if those permit holders are constrained by the kind of operation they can grow, if they're encouraged to grow indoors, which is incredibly bad for the environment just on its own terms, we could well see a situation where California sets up a legalized, legal white market, if you will, as opposed to the black market that now exists, but leaves in place the conditions that maintain a black market here in the Emerald Triangle. Basically, Utah is not going to legalize anytime soon. There's going to remain a black market for marijuana in the U.S.
All right, so the operations in California then would likely be serving other states, because California, if it went to that system like Washington, would be keeping it in the hands of just a few people.
Relatively. And so my argument is that if we mean to undo the harms of prohibition, and Steve is, I think, spot on when he says that a lot of these harms are about prohibition. That's exactly right. But if we mean to undo those harms across not only this small region, as important as it is to me, but also across society, we have to look at what those harms are and really build policies that address them. And in the case of the Emerald Triangle, I think that means we need to recognize that we have an industry here that has really pioneered this product, this culture, and is in a position to come into the light if we make it workable for the industry. But if we don't, it's going to continue to go ahead and do its thing. And frankly, they've outlasted 30 years of law enforcement. There's little to indicate to me that California or the federal government really has much of a stomach for the kind of enforcement actions, the scale and intensity of law enforcement you'd have to do to really dial the industry back in this region. I think we really don't have much choice but to move forward with an appropriate, well worked out legalization program. But I don't see that on the horizon right now.
Mm-hmm. Scott Greason is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Executive Director at Friends of the Eel River. We're talking about watershed impacts from marijuana grows in the Emerald Triangle of California. You can join this discussion. We'll take a few more minutes here at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Mark in Redding, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, two questions. One, is the vast majority of the land that this is being grown on government, state or federal owned? And are the majority of growers independent growers, or are they part of some cartel?
All right. So federal or state land, independent or cartels? Thanks for the call, Mark.
The quick answer is the vast majority of marijuana grown in the Emerald Triangle is getting grown on relatively small private parcels with the knowledge of the owners. That's not to say that there isn't still a huge problem with what we call the trespass grows, folks who are associated with, as I said, drug trafficking organizations. There's an interesting aside there that the federal officials who've for years argued that those guys are, quote-unquote, the cartels associated with the Mexican drug trafficking cartels, have in recent years disavowed that claim and said, well, in a actually, we've tried really hard to make that case, and we can't. That's part of the reason that many of us have taken to referring to those organizations as trespass grows. In the case of the eel, we're talking about a watershed that's more than 85% private land. So it really is a matter of how are folks using their own land. And as I said, I think the consensus is pretty clear in California, and particularly in this region, that it's okay for people to grow weed on their own land. I think what we need to do is get some clarity about what the boundaries are on that. Is it okay to grow 1,000 plants? Is it okay to grow 1,000 plants within 100 feet of a stream that's got coho salmon in it? What's okay to use on your plants? Those are the questions that still loom, really.
And so, Scott, we haven't gotten into the numbers about fish. What is the general state of fish runs on the eel at this point?
Well, I'll be kind of vague, but big picture, we had coming into the falls of 2012, 2013, a real resurgence in runs. We saw for Chinook salmon, one of the three species of listed fish we've got in the Eel River, runs of 5 to 8,000 fish coming up to the fish counting station that's on the lower of the two Potter Valley Project dams. And that looked to us like it probably meant we had numbers maybe as high as 20 to 40,000 Chinook in the river system, which is great, but it's still only about 10% of what the runs were at a century ago. At the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. So we've got the, sort of a surge in fish coming back in this decade that really looks like, okay, they could start coming back, but we're still at pretty low levels. So for the coho, the silver salmon, where the population in the South Fork eel is really the anchor, not just for the eel watershed, but for all of the streams and rivers on the north coast of California, from the Mattole on up to the Oregon border, we're probably looking at something like 2,000 to 3,000 fish in those good years in terms of the number of adults coming back. That's not a huge number, and if we don't turn around the trajectory of coho, especially if we don't see those fish coming back in watersheds where they were present in the 90s but haven't been present since then, we're probably going to lose those fish and with them the prospects for coho recovery in the whole region. So that's really the question that's front and center in my mind as I look at the watershed impacts of marijuana cultivation is, are we leaving enough for the fish? Are we still making it possible for these incredibly tough, resilient critters to carve out the little bit of time and space they need in the watersheds to make another round, to keep coming back as they have for millions and millions of years.
Got just about a minute and a half left, Scott. I want to ask, given existing law and regulation, what levers are really available to help change the situation?
Well, I think there are a couple of big things, and here Jerry Brown gets some credit. He has boosted the budget for both the Department of Fish and Wildlife and for the Regional Water Board, and both those agencies have important roles to play, particularly because in the last couple of years, their field staff has made it really clear that they're not there to bust weed. They're not there to eradicate marijuana per se. They're doing a fair amount of that in worst-case situations where people are doing a lot of harm with their operations. But really what they're saying is we're interested in making sure you're using your water in a way that's okay for the fish and abiding by the environmental rules that should apply to everyone.
All right, which is sort of like what's happening with the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board, where they're inspecting grows and handing out violations where they find them. So
that's right.
Yeah, levers that are in existence at the moment. Scott Greeson is the executive director of Friends of the Eel River. We've been talking about marijuana growing impacts on rivers like the Eel. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
All right, we'll take a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange and come back with Garrison Keillor. Then we'll talk about OR7.